Krantara Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 This is text number 27. You have a book, huh? Yeah, but it's on page 276. It's chapter 5. You have?
Yeah.
Tasmin stada labda ruchir mahamati.
Tasmin stada labda ruchir mahamati.
Priyas shravasyas kalita matir mama.
Priyas shravasyas kalita matir mama.
Yayaham etat sadasat swamaya.
Yayaham etat sadasat swamaya.
Pasye mahi brahmani kalpitam pare.
Pasye mahi brahmani kalpitam pare.
Tasmin.
Tasmin.
It being so.
Being so.
Tada.
At that time,
labdha, achieved, ruchay,
taste,
mahamati,
O
great sage,
priyashravasi,
upon the Lord,
Oskalita
matihi.
Oskalita matihi.
Uninterrupted attention.
Uninterrupted attention.
Mama.
Mama.
My.
My.
Yaya.
Yaya.
By which.
By which.
I.
I.
Etat.
Etat.
All these.
All these.
Sat asat.
Sat asat.
Gross and subtle.
Swamaya,
one's own ignorance. Pashye,
see,
Mayi,
in me, Brahmani,
the supreme.
Kalpitam,
is accepted.
Pare,
in the transcendence.
In the transcendence.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. O great sage, as soon as I got a taste of the personality of Godhead, my attention to hear of the Lord was unflinching. And as my taste developed, I could realize that it was only in my ignorance that I had accepted gross and subtle coverings. For both the Lord and I am transcendental. Purport. Ignorance in material existence is compared to darkness. And in all Vedic literatures, the personality of Godhead is compared to the sun. Wherever there is light, there cannot be darkness. Hearing of the Lord's pastimes is itself transcendental association with the Lord, because there is no difference between the Lord and His transcendental pastimes. To become associated with the spiritual life, light, is to dissipate all darkness. By ignorance only, the conditioned soul wrongly thinks that both he and the Lord are products of material nature. But in fact, the personality of Godhead and the living beings are transcendental, and they have nothing to do with the material nature. When ignorance is removed, and it is perfectly realized that there is nothing existing without the personality of Godhead, then nescience is removed. Since the gross and subtle bodies are emanations from the personality of Godhead, the knowledge of light permits one to engage both of them in the service of the Lord. The gross body should be engaged in acts of rendering service to the Lord, as in bringing water, cleansing the temple, or making obeisances, etc. The path of archana, or worshipping the Lord in the temple, involves engaging one's gross body in the service of the Lord. Similarly, the subtle mind should be engaged in hearing the transcendental pastimes of the Lord, thinking about them, chanting his name, etc. All such activities are transcendental. None of the gross or subtle senses should otherwise be engaged. Such realization of transcendental activities is made possible by many, many years of apprenticeship in the devotional service, but simply attraction of love for the personality of Godhead, as it was developed by Narada Muni by hearing, is highly effective. Yes, Rupa Goswami does recommend what he calls Yukta Vairagya, but it doesn't mean that his movement is a movement just of dovetailing. Dovetailing, or in other words, using your material, taking what you are now as a conditioned soul with material desires and material attachments, you can use what you have and be what you are. I'm not yet a perfect saint. I'm not free from all material desires, but I can, in my current position, with my current attachments and my current entanglements, I can use what I have for Krishna's service. That's what we mean by dovetailing. But that's not the ultimate principle of Krishna consciousness, the way it was taught by Rupa Goswami, the way it was taught by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Lord Chaitanya's idea of perfect Krishna consciousness is complete surrender. And it's Rupa Goswami's idea too, anyabhilashita shunyam. Pure devotional service is really meant to be free from all other motivations. So that's our goal, is to be totally dedicated to Krishna and have no selfish interest. We're allowed for now to maintain some selfish interests. They may be our own, they may be imposed on us by family and friends or by the society, but they're selfish. Now, material is material. We may take material things and use them for Krishna, but they're still material. And they're still causes of entanglement, and they're connected with the material energy, with ignorance. But wherever there is light, there cannot be darkness, and Krishna is the transcendental sun. So, although that may paint a dismal picture, that we're not yet pure devotees and Krishna's just tolerating our material attachments. But the thing is that following this process, even starting with dovetailing, just dovetailing and not being completely unalloyed, surrendered, still even that, starting from that stage, the process has the potency to channel Krishna's mercy in such a way that we lose all material interest. We start with material attachments and try to do something for Krishna, but by doing something for Krishna, by establishing a relationship with him and his devotees, we become not only purified, but empowered to be Krishna's servants. What Narada Muni did was not, Prabhupada talks in the purport that normally, basically what he's saying, is that normally it takes a long time to become Krishna conscious. Prabhupada talks about many years of apprenticeship. We have each been serving this apprenticeship for some number of years, or maybe months. Some of us for decades. And we're still apprentices. We haven't graduated yet. You know, we're not master craftsmen yet, we're still apprentices. Even after 30 years or so. But Narada Muni, he only took a few weeks to become perfect. He's a counterexample. That doesn't have to take a whole lifetime or a big chunk of a lifetime to become fully Krishna conscious. It can be done in a short time. And Narada Muni is the example. You know, it seems to have been all within 1 year. The sages came, stayed for 3 months, and then quickly after that, by the time they left, he already had bhakti. He already had love of God. And he had to go to the forest. His mother passed away, and he was still 5 years old. He was 5 years old at the beginning of the story. He was 5 years old when his mother passed away, and he went to the forest, Hare Krishna. So it was within 1 year. You know, he didn't even have his sixth birthday. So not even 1 year passed. That means in a matter of weeks or maybe a few months, Narada Muni achieved his perfection. And most of us have already been through at least 1 year of Krishna consciousness and haven't accomplished that. You know, we haven't been able to sit down under a tree and see Lord Narayan in our heart and have him talk to us in the sky. Now, even though we've been practicing maybe for 10 years or 15 years or 20 or 30 years. So it may take a whole lifetime, but it may also be quick. Really all we need to do is become attracted to Krishna. And the easiest and most effective way to do that is to simply hear and chant about Krishna. We can try the traditional yoga system of meditation that was, as it was taught by Patanjali Rishi in the Yoga Sutras and practiced by many yogis over the ages. That's more difficult than simply hearing and chanting about Krishna. Prabhupada talks about different ways of becoming Krishna conscious. He talks about the standard method of deity worship. Many Vaishnavas are doing that. Either they're, like in the Sri Sampradaya, there are many Brahmins in the Sri Sampradaya, and they at home do puja, and other Vaishnavas throughout India. Brahmins and even those who are not Brahmanas, they're performing their deity worship at home. And many others who don't do that, they go to the temples, they go to the tirthas, and they take darshan. They may not perform the that's still too high, it's gonna create feedback. Okay. It's a matter of putting it up too high and that happens. Okay? Is it on now? It may, okay, then what you have to do, I think, is put the speaker back. Don't keep it close to me, you have to put it away, yeah. That's the problem, the speaker's too close to the... That's good. It just has to be in front, it can't be... If it's right next to me, then I get feedback. No, that's good, that's safe now. It just has to be... The speaker has to be put in front or behind the speaker, not, you know, if it's next, then you get this feedback. Okay. So many Vaishnavas, especially in other sampradayas, they put great emphasis on the method of worshipping the deity of Krishna. Narada himself wrote one of the most important textbooks on that method. He wrote the Narada Pancharatra. That book is actually mentioned in the Bhagavatam that he did that. You know, it's not that, oh, someone else wrote it, you know, put the name of Narada on it. If we believe what the Bhagavatam says, Narada did write such a book. It's described right here in the Bhagavatam that he wrote the Pancharatra, his own Pancharatra, called the Narada Pancharatra. And what's that book about? How to worship Krishna by chanting mantras and by worshipping the deity. So that's what we call the Pancharatrika method, the method of primarily of chanting mantras and worshipping the deity. And most devotees of Vishnu throughout India are following primarily that process. But our sampradaya is a little different. We do worship the deity. We have temples. And it's recommended that devotees who want to be trained up in Krishna consciousness, they become students and stay in those temples for a few years. We have ashrams for brahmacharis. Prabhupada was so radical, he even opened up those ashrams for ladies in the West. The temples are centers where devotees can come, either live here or come and visit, and get trained by seeing the deity of Krishna and by hearing from the devotees. But in our sampradaya, the Vaishnava school coming from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we put more emphasis on the hearing and the chanting than on the worship of the deity. We have our deity worship, we have our temples. The devotees who live in the temples are expected to come to the Mangalarti in the morning. You're living in the house, the temple, the Malik, the master of the house, is Krishna. The servants are expected to report in the morning to the master. So we're expected to be there. Those living in the temple have to be there. Now it's a great apparat for the servants not to report to the master in the morning. We have to be there. Krishna wakes up, we have to be there when the curtains open. So the temple, the deity worship is going on in our ISKCON centers. But that's not our main process. Our main process is Harinam Sankirtan. This is Hare Krishna movement, not the puja movement. The worship is there, but the Sankirtana is even more important. It's more potent. And devotional service rises to a higher level by the potent practice of this Harinam Sankirtana. When the deity is worshipped, and the kirtan is only, the arti is only accompanied by bang, bang, bang of bells, that's not as pleasing to Krishna as when there's kirtan, when there's singing and dancing and glorification of his names. That's what pleases Krishna more. So Narada, although he wrote the book about formalized mantra meditation and deity worship, that's not the practice that he himself followed. He wrote a book for neophytes, but he himself was on a higher level. He engaged in the pure bhagavad-vidhi. In other words, that's what he said. O Vyasadeva, in that association of the sages, Narada, the son of the maidservant, serving the guests, in that association, and by the mercy of those great Vedantists, I could hear them describe the attractive activities of Lord Krishna. And thus, listening attentively, my taste for hearing of the personality of Godhead increased at every step. And then today's verse follows after that. O great sage, as soon as I got a taste of the personality of Godhead, my attention to hear of the Lord was unflinching. And as my taste developed, I could realize that it was only in my ignorance that I accepted gross and subtle coverings. For both the Lord and I are transcendental. So what did Narada do? What was his practice? Basically, because we go back another verse, I didn't go back two verses, but the verse before says he got the Uchishta, the Mahaprasad, from the plates of those sages. He took their prasad. Then he heard their Krishna katha, and not just some katha by some paid man who was just doing it for money. Professional katha. But devotion, actually devoted katha, by pure devotees. That is basically the whole process that Narada followed. Just hearing. About just by hearing from a potent speaker the glories of Krishna, Narada Muni quickly developed love of God. And we can do that too. Just Shravanam and Kirtanam, hearing and chanting about Krishna, is more effective than all these other rituals, including the worship of the deity of Krishna. Not that we stop the deity worship, but we only do these things on the strength, the worship of the deity, the performance of yajna, meditation. We do these only on the strength of Harinam, of Nam Sankirtan. Karabhajana Muni is describing how the Lord appears in each age and teaches appropriate methods of basically Krishna consciousness in each age. And he also appears in our current Kali Yuga. Kalavapi Tatana Srinu. And please hear, dear King Nimi, how just as he appeared in the previous ages in his various forms, and he taught different method of devotional practice of each age, he also appears in Kali Yuga. And let me describe that to you. Tatana Srinu. Krishna Varnam Trisha Krishnam Sangopangashtaparshanam Yagyai Sankirtanatrayayar Yajanti Hi Sumeda Saha. In Kali Yuga, maybe not everybody worships Krishna. We see that there are many Krishna bhaktas and there are many other people who are not interested in worshiping Krishna. They worship somebody else or they worship nobody. Or they say that the Supreme is formless and he doesn't have a name. But some people worship Krishna. And in the opinion of Karabhajana, take it for what it's worth, it's his opinion, they're intelligent people and other people are less intelligent. People who are really smart, Sumedhas are. Medhas means brain tissue. But that's just figurative. It doesn't matter how fat physically your brain is. When Albert Einstein died, someone got permission to take his skull and measured his brain. It wasn't that abnormally big, a little big, bigger than your normal, but it didn't really account for the genius of Albert Einstein, the size of his, you know, the weight of his brain tissue. So Subedha said must be taken poetically. It's not, you know, according to how many grams of, you know, muscle you have in your brain. Mm-hmm. It's according to how smart you are. And that's not even, you know, what they measure as IQ or some, you know, passing some university examination. This is spiritual intelligence. The person who's illiterate may have more of it than the person who's got a PhD. Mm-hmm. Spiritual intelligence. People who are actually smart, the way the sage sees it, Karabhajana Rishi, they worship Krishna even in Kali Yuga. But they worship him in a peculiar way. Krishna, anybody who knows anything about Krishna knows that he's dark complexioned, Shyama. Krishna Varnam Tricha Akrishnam, but they're worshiping some form of Krishna that's just the opposite color. Unwhite, unblack. Asita, Sita is black, Asita is white. Akrishna means Pita Varnam, golden complexion. This is a riddle. How can someone worship Krishna when Krishna is not black? Answer, when he's Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is not going to be mentioned in the Bhagavatam. That's supposed to be a secret. Lord Chaitanya didn't reveal himself until he was way into his adulthood. I think he was 18 or 20 years old when he actually started his Sankirtan movement. And before that, he didn't reveal, even to his devotees, that he was Krishna himself. Even his intimate associates couldn't recognize him as Krishna until he decided, okay, I'm going to reveal myself to my intimate devotees. So, how is Shukadeva Goswami and Suta Goswami speaking 5,000 years ago, how are they supposed to reveal this? When Lord Chaitanya himself didn't want to reveal it until the time was right. It wasn't supposed to be revealed in the pages of the Bhagavatam that Lord Chaitanya is Krishna. So it doesn't say that, it just hints at it. Smart people in Kali Yuga, they worship black Krishna when he's not black. Figure that out. We won't tell you that it's actually Lord Chaitanya, because we're not supposed to tell you. You know,
5,000 years before the fact. But if you're one of those smart people, then you can figure it out. Krishna Varnam Trisha Krishnam. He's Krishna himself, and he's just the opposite color on the outside, his effulgence. Sarvoparna Aashra Parshadam. And he's accompanied. He's not alone. He didn't come down from the spiritual sky all by himself, but he's accompanied by many devotees. His principal and secondary associates. Generally, Lord Vishnu has got his ayudas and his angas. He's got bodily limbs. Sometimes he has four arms, sometimes he has eight arms, sometimes he has two arms, sometimes he has a body of an animal, a fish, a tortoise. He has different kinds of bodily configurations, angas. And this is metaphorically compared to his principal and his secondary associates, angas and upangas, primary and secondary limbs. Primary limbs are, just like a person has two arms. If you had a choice, would you get your leg chopped off or your arms? Now you have to lose a limb. Which would you choose? Probably keep the arms. Because you can't type with your feet, but you can type with your hands. Many, many dexterous activities you can only do with your hands, not with your feet.
Yeah.
So if you had to choose between losing your hand and your feet, keep the hands and give up the feet. So the primary limbs are the arms. And they are, that's metaphorically standing for Lord Nityananda and Advaita Acharya, primary associate of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he has many others, hundreds and millions of associates. And his weapons. Lord Vishnu is always coming with weapons. Now he's got his which ones? Panchajanyas. Yeah, well he has four generally. You always see Vishnu with chakra, shankha, gada, padma. And sometimes he has more. Sometimes he's with 10 arms, he fills up each of the arms with a weapon. With 20 arms, with 1,000 arms, he's got a weapon in each arm. He usually has to do some fighting. He's got demons to kill, usually. So he comes with weapons. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he's basically taken a vow of non-violence. This wasn't invented by Gandhi. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was completely observing the principles of non-violence. He didn't kill anybody. Although most of the avatars of Vishnu are pretty good at killing anybody who stands in their way. Krishna and Balaram, at the age of 11, entered Dwarka city like a couple of hoodlums, sauntering down the street, and they saw the dobi. Dobi's just a workman. You're not a big demon. Who is he? Just a washerman. Why pick on him? But they said, give us those clothes. And they said, what do you mean? This is King Kamsa's clothes. Who are you, little kids? What do you want? And they responded by, Krishna responded by cutting off the washerman's head. Quite violent. And then later on, Krishna was even much more violent when he became Prince of Dwarka. Many battles in which there were rivers and lakes of blood, filled with the severed limbs of the combatants. But that's Krishna and most of his avatars. Part of their business is vinashaya cha dushkritam, killing demons, for the protection of the innocent and his devotees. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he takes a style of non-violence. He protects his devotees, and he kills the demoniac spirit by the potency of his Nam Sankirtana, the hearing and chanting of Krishna's glories, without killing anybody. If he were to start killing, he'd have to kill everybody. If you're going to start picking out demons, in Kali Yuga it's described that in Kali Yuga, in the previous ages, in the first age, Satya Yuga, demons and devotees used to live on different planets. And then in the Treta Yuga, they lived in the same planet but in different countries. So in Treta Yuga, Lord Ramachandra was living in Ayodhya and Ravana was living on, across the ocean on a different big island, you know, a different country. In Dwarka Yuga, maybe the same country. Demons and devotees might live in the same country, but at least in different cities. Just like Rukmi, when Krishna kidnapped his sister, he vowed that I will leave my father's city and I will go find, start my own city, Bojakuta, and I won't leave it. I won't go back to my father's kingdom until Rukmini marries Shishupal. So the demons and devotees, they at least they have their own kingdoms, separate kingdoms, separate cities in Dwarka Yuga. But in Kali Yuga, they're living in the same bodies. It's like you see the cartoon of a man with a demon with a pitchfork on one shoulder and an angel on the other shoulder, both talking in his ear. We have demoniac spirit in our own heart, every one of us in Kali Yuga. It's the gross contamination of this age. So what would Chaitanya Mahaprabhu have to do if he started killing demons? He'd have to kill everybody. And that's more the spirit or the activity of Lord Kalki, not of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he has to take, for practical purposes, he has to take a vow of non-violence. But he has his weapons. And that is his holy names. Those holy names destroy the demoniac spirit lurking in our own hearts. That's the potency. Anyone who's smart enough will worship Krishna in that form of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and participate. Yajyaik Sankirtana Prayaya. People worship God by performing yajna, various forms of what we call in English sacrifice, although it's an unfortunate term, just like incarnation for avatar. Et incarnatus, that they pray in the Roman Catholic Mass. Et incarnatus, and he became flesh. God took a body made out of flesh, skin and bones. Well, we understand Krishna says, I appear Atma Maya. I don't take a body of skin and bones, a body of flesh. Krishna never does that. We do that. That's our problem, but Krishna never does that. When he comes in a purely spiritual body. So when we call it incarnation in English, that's not so good, but that's all that's available in English. Unless we want to leave it in Sanskrit as avatar. So that's just the weakness of the English language. So the same thing with sacrifice, yajna. Yajna means a ritual performed ultimately either directly or indirectly for the pleasure of the Supreme. Yajna vai Vishnu. The sacrifice is Vishnu himself, or it's meant for Vishnu's pleasure. But in English, sacrifice means to kill somebody. Human sacrifice or an animal sacrifice. It's got a bad connotation, just like incarnation in English. So when you do a sacrifice, it doesn't mean that you have to suffer, undergo a sacrifice. Sacrifice means to act for the pleasure of God. It doesn't mean you have to suffer, it doesn't mean you have to kill anybody. But in general, worshiping God means to perform yajna, to do something. Not just to have good intentions or some sentiment. Do something for God. That's service. Offer something. That's yajna in different forms. And in Kali Yuga, intelligent people perform yajna to worship Krishna in the form of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sankirtana Prayaya. Primarily by hearing and chanting Krishna's names and various descriptions of Krishna's glories. Primarily. Because other things can be done. We do also worship the deity. We've got a big temple just up the stairs. And everybody's coming to take darshan, to see the arati. Devotees are performing the arati. This is part of our process. But the primary essence of our process is, first of all, hearing and chanting Krishna's names. And because we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're empowered to also worship the deity. If we didn't chant Hare Krishna, then we wouldn't be able to carry on this deity worship. At least we shouldn't. If we did, it would be a fiasco. And places where they try to worship some form of the Lord and don't do any sankirtan, it is just a fiasco. There's no life to it. Krishna's present in his form, but he's not going to be interested in your worship if you don't glorify his holy name. Even if you bang some bells, that's not enough. If there's kirtan, then the puja is accepted. Otherwise, it's just some business deal. Like the dukandar in the morning, waving a stick at Gaja Lakshmi, and hoping that she'll fill his cash register. But that's just business. It's just part of the business. It's not devotion. And worship, having a grand temple, even if millions of people come to it every day, if you're not chanting the pure glories of the Lord, then it's just an external show. It's just doing business. This is a big business. In India, it is big business. Building temples and raking in the money. But it's just external if there isn't glorification of Krishna. So, Sankirtana Prayer. We worship the deities as an adjunct of hearing and chanting about Krishna. And we are only able to do it because we're hearing and chanting about Krishna. We also sometimes perform fire sacrifices for initiation, for weddings, for funerals. But only because we're chanting Hare Krishna. Otherwise, who are we to be performing yajnas? Who are we to sit and meditate on Krishna's lotus feet? But if you do the same thing Narada did, listen to the pure devotees glorifying Krishna, then you'll also, maybe not in a few weeks, but eventually, you'll also get attraction, real attraction, to Krishna. And that attraction is the key to success. It's just one step away from pure love, to be seriously attracted to hearing about him, to really have a taste. Narada uses the word ruchi. It's the same word that Rupa Goswami uses in his textbook, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Ruchi means asakti, or attraction to Krishna, serious attraction. Once you have that, there's no turning back. It's just a matter of time before you develop complete, pure love of God. So all we have to do is do the same thing Narada did. Hear about Krishna, and then we can also do some chanting about Krishna. We can tell someone else about Krishna after we've heard. And that's the best, most effective way to develop this attraction to Krishna. When you're attracted to Krishna, as the verse in purport tell us today, then all our material complications in our life, all our misgivings, all our bad habits and bad conditioning will simply dissolve. It'll go away. All the reasons why we're only dovetailing and not completely surrendering ourselves with no conditions are because we still have these misgivings, we still have these entanglements, but they will go away if we want them to. If we want to give them up, we can easily give them up, at least in due course of time, sooner or later, simply by becoming more and more attracted to hearing about Krishna. Okay, so I'll stop there. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, people.
Well, you had said that Narada, in a few weeks, he was able to generate his love for the God. But then we have an example of Khatwang, who developed the love of God within two muhurats, manuhurat or so. So how do we equate that? Is it Khatwang, he's more...
It says about Khatwang, Khatwang Abhayam Harim. He came down to earth to take shelter of Hari. That really just says that he came down to start his devotional practice. Of course, he was told he only had a second to live. I don't know, maybe he came down and they said, well, we were just kidding with you, and you have 5 months. I don't know what happened when he came down. But he got a start on his devotion. It doesn't say he attained prema in 1 second. Just like a jamil, I'm sorry. I'll say two sentences then. Ajamil, Ajamil also was, you know, he died. And the Yamadutas were ready to take him away, and the Vishnudutas stopped them because he accidentally chanted the name of Narayan. But he didn't attain perfection immediately. He was given his life back and had to spend about 6 months practicing devotional service at Hardwar. Then the Vishnudutas came finally to get him. So it may have been similar with Katwanga. It doesn't say that he immediately attained love of God, but he got a good start on it. So it's not that he was quicker and faster and better than Narada, necessarily. Okay.
But then when it said that love master sadhu sang service is zero, that means the moment of association is much more important.
Yeah, but yes. Well, even a moment. It doesn't mean don't take more than a moment of devotee's association, but even a moment. And it doesn't say you get the perfection immediately. It may be withheld until you're ready for it.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Madam Martin? According to their measurement. Oh yeah, if they meant a second by their count, and then yeah, they had plenty of time.
6 months.
6 months? Yeah. About the same time that the John Hill stuff. We don't know that we have 6 months. We don't know. Yeah. We better hurry it up. Okay, anything else?
In Bhagavatam we see, as you have been talking about demons and demigods, so in Bhagavatam we see demons are defined as who don't worship Vishnu and who don't worship. This is a primary definition of a demon. But in Bhagavatam we see Bali Maharaj is worshipping Brahmanas
There's two different definitions. There's the devotional definition and the external definition. Indrari Vyakulam, Indrari, enemies of Indra, is the other definition. There's two races, the Devatas, the sons of Aditi and the sons of Diti. It's really just a family feud between the Asuras and the demigods of heaven. And you got devotees on both sides. Actually, you have Vaishnavas on both sides. So it's more complicated than that. It's not just the Vaishnavas against the non-Vaishnavas. The real demons by the real definition, the essential definition, the actual spiritual definition is that anybody who's not a devotee of Vishnu is a demon. Vishnu bhakta smito daiva asuras tadvipariya. Vishnu Purana says, a devotee of Vishnu, I'm not just saying that, Vishnu Purana says it, a devotee of Vishnu is a deva. And anybody on the other side who's not a devotee of Vishnu is a demon, asuras. But there's the superficial understanding that the sons of Aditi are the demigods and the sons of Diti are the demons, and they're his natural enemies. But that's just the external view of it. Okay?
One more question.
Yeah, please.
Just like you're talking about deity worship, and if you go to Udupi, like the Udupi Krishna is there, and
yes.
So I've been to Madhvas, I'm talking to Madhvas, and
yes.
And they were telling that actually they invite Udupi Krishna there in the deity.
Yes.
And afterwards, when they make him sleep, then he goes, and then it's the deity. So how do you understand that?
They say the Krishna's not there when
yeah, because after they make him sleep.
When the deities,
everybody can see him, like, because they say that Paramatma is manifest, he is made to come in that, and then...
Really, they say that?
Yeah,
I never heard that, I don't know what to say about that.
Because
they say that Krishna is not present in his deity form when they put the deity to rest, that the soul is not there?
No, they make him sleep.
Well, they make him sleep when? Every day?
Yeah, every day. And
after lunch, he goes to sleep, right?
No, in the night.
In the night, okay.
And then after that, the curtains are not closed.
Curtains are not closed.
Because he is supposed to be not in that deity, he is supposed to be in the swing on the other side where he is sleeping. And I mean to say, I've been talking to a sannyasi there, and that's why I wanted to clear my mind.
I don't know.
I just recall
Krishna can do that if he wants. Yes?
I was just recalling the incident of Jarbharat with the Kali Devi.
Yes.
The robbers were prepared to kill Jarbharat, but she was already there and she immediately reacted. Even Jarbharat was not at all interested. So I'm just saying that maybe the deities, it's not that, as Prabhupada says, they're all small post boxes who send all the information to the head post office. So they're all living. It's not that it's.
Right, it's not just a representation, but. Well, I don't know about demigods. Maybe, you know, I don't know an authoritative statement that the demigods are non-different than their forms, but there are statements that Krishna is non-different than his form, than his name, any representation of him. So there's a real sense in which Krishna is there, and even an uninstalled deity, what to speak of a deity that's been put to sleep, a deity that was never even installed. Any picture of Krishna, Krishna is in the picture. He is the picture, he's not different from it. Any representation, any name, image of Krishna. But still, we install the deity. There's another sense in which Krishna is not promising to accept our worship until we establish a formal relationship. When we install the deity, we're telling Krishna, we promise to do regular daily worship. And Krishna says, okay, I'll come and accept it every day.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, Krishna's there in the statue. He's always there. But we didn't make any promise to do any particular puja, and he didn't make any promise to accept it. There's a contract established by installing the deity. So maybe they're talking about that, the Madhvais, you know, about Krishna. You know, he promises to take, you know, to be there for darshan certain times, the other times is you know, off hours and he's on a break. Yeah. But he's actually there in the deity, he's just not, he's not available for darshan, if that's what they're saying.
Yes, definitely. I also have...
He's on a break, that's all.
In Tirupati, in a particular season of the year, Lord Balaji, he descends down to Padmavali at the foot of the hills.
Yes.
So that time his Archana Vigraha, that is a small form,
yes.
taken down to the foothills and there he gives darshan.
Yes.
And upstairs they say Balaji, he prefers to give darshan at the foothills along with his consort.
But they don't stop the worship.
No, they don't stop the worship.
In the main temple. So he's still there. He's still there.
He's still there, but
in both places. When Krishna, you know, has expanded form, he's usually in all the places at once. But anyway, I don't think it means that Krishna is not there, but he doesn't want to, you know, he's just saying, you know, leave me alone, I'm on my break. Yeah.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes.
Actually, in this purpose, we have been seeing that the holy name of the Lord is like association with the devotee, or with Krishna.
Yes.
The devotee is associating with Krishna.
By chanting,
by
right?
Chanting.
Hearing, yes.
Yeah, that's the principle we all agree. But the point is that so many times it is said that one should chant with a feeling of separation. So, you understand my point?
Well, we usually don't have a problem that we can't be separated from Krishna. Our problem is usually that we have too much separation from Krishna. Not that, you know, because I'm chanting Krishna's name, then, you know, gee, he's there and I can't be separated from him. Devotees who are not very advanced, they feel separated all the time because they can't see Krishna. They're chanting, but they don't get the taste, they don't have the full taste for it, so they don't experience Krishna there, even though he's there. So for immature devotees, separation is there because of lack of taste and lack of realization. And for the most mature devotees, even if he's right with them, embracing them. They're afraid that he could disappear at any moment. You know, this is the highest stage of separation. And even in Krishna's immediate presence, they're worried, their anxiety for his separation. Then there may be something in between, but it's usually not our problem that we've got too much association with Krishna and therefore we can't enjoy his separation. Usually we've got more separation than we can handle. Yeah. Especially in our, yeah, look at it. I mean, we missed Krishna by 5,000 years. We missed Lord Chaitanya by 500 years. Many of us missed Prabhupada by a few years. Plenty of opportunities to feel separation. Yeah. Okay? I mean, you know, that's not our problem. Okay?
You said that door telling is the initial process. And the final is to surrender Krishna.
No conditions. Yes.
So what does surrender mean? That whatever we have, we have to leave it, and then we, what does surrender mean? Because whatever we possess, if we are utilizing in the service of Krishna, that is to obtain only.
Anything that we have that we think is ours, we have to turn it over to Krishna. It's not mine, it's yours. You do what you want with it. I no longer claim any say in what's done with my body, my family, anything. It's all yours. You use it. That's surrender. Yeah. And Krishna says, well, I want you to use it. I want you to be the caretaker and take care of it for me. Then you accept to be Krishna's caretaker. You have no right to dispose of or to throw away something that isn't your property. So when you disclaim proprietorship over your own body, you have no right to destroy it. And you have no right to give up anything when it's not yours in the first place. You said you give it up, so you have no right to. You said you gave it to Krishna. You have no right to renounce it now. It's Krishna's. I renounce that car across the street. But it's not mine to renounce. I don't own it. What's the use of saying that? Yeah. So I can't renounce my own body. It doesn't belong to me. That's what surrender is. Turn everything over to Krishna. And it's not yours anymore at all. Okay?
Another question. In Jagannath Puri, when Rath Yatra, the process is there,
yes,
they don't do any kirtan and chanting or whatever.
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his devotees did.
But now
that changed the Rath Yatra, you know, and the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, they still do. They may be a small minority in the crowd of 3 million people, but they're there. The Gaudiya Mutt and the Iskand devotees, they have kirtan. And others do also. They may not be, you know, most people don't, but there's some kirtan going on. Prabhupada warned that you better watch out. You know, told the pandas that the pujaris there, that Lord is going to leave if you keep on mistreating him like this. Now, Lord Jagannath is not pleased that the kirtan is not going on. You know, the pujaris are eating fish and other things are going on. Okay, so Jagannath's there because he does it every year, but I'm sure he wasn't as pleased as he could have been. And 1 year he's not going to show up.
During
one of these years.
Doing the kirtan in the back is no problem.
Doing kirtan, you mean behind the kirtan?
Because when the
Jagannath
Rath Yatra is going
on,
so it's so crowded in Jagannath.
Lord Chaitanya would have his devotees doing kirtan on all sides. Behind, in front, on sides. So it's okay. Not everybody can be standing in front of it, especially in a big crowd. Not everybody can be in front of the deity. It's not offensive to be behind in such a situation. And we're having kirtan on all sides. That's increased glorification. Stereophonic kirtan on all sides. Okay.
When Krishna took birth, he first appeared in Chaturbhuji form.
Yes.
So why did he appear in Chaturbhuji? Because originally Krishna is present as Krishna in Bolo. So why did he appear in this Vishnu?
I don't remember. There's some esoteric description of that. Gopal, Champu, Vishnu, Charyabhari, they say something about why Krishna appeared to Devaki and Vasudeva in forearms. I can't remember, I don't want to fake it. But Vasudeva and Devaki had some tinge of reverence for Krishna. Their love was not as pure as Nanda and Yashoda. So they had to see Narayan first, and then he turned into an ordinary child for them. You know, they had to get it out of their system first. Yeah. Spent a few minutes worshipping his Narayan, then he switched over. But then he had to leave. Then he had not, you know, Vasudeva take him away. And they didn't see him again until he was grown up. Nanda Yashoda got to have him as an ordinary child and have him for his whole childhood. So that in a sense is Nanda and Yashoda, and I'd rather Vasudeva and Devaki, let's not say misfortune, but it's a special way that he deals with them. Is that they have to be aware that he's God. They can never get that out of their heads. So to prove it, he appeared as Narayan first. and then showed himself as Krishna.
I'm asking this just because of preaching point of view, because people ask so many times.
Yes.
If Krishna is Supreme Personality, why did he appear in the form of Chaturbhuja, and why did he show this form to Arjuna also?
But the devotees to whom he showed his Chaturbhuja were not the ones he showed his most favor to. He showed his most favor to Nanda and Yashoda. Yeah, they're considered greater devotees than Vasudeva and Devaki. So the devotees who worship the Chaturbhuja, they're very great devotees. But the devotees who worship his two armed forms are better devotees.
So I just have one simple question.
Yes.
Are there any conditions for worshipping in Shubhu early morning? Is this fixed time for worshipping God? Or you can do it at any time during the day, night, or there is no fixed time?
Well, there's recommended, there's better times. The morning is generally better for all kinds of meditative activities, you know, spiritual activities. The early morning in general is best. Mm-hmm. Even before sunrise is really the best. So before you go, you know, get into your passionate activities of the day, before you start doing your business, it's better to do at least the initial worship. You may do other worship during the day, but the time when you can really concentrate on it is before you get busy with other things. It's a practical thing. It's not exact fixed time, but it's better before you get involved in your daily business to worship Krishna at least once. You know, spend a few minutes with him before you go out and do everything else.
There's a best time to worship early in the morning, but in case some reasons you are not able to do it in the morning, then is it it's not good to do it in, during the daytime or at night time? Is it prohibited to do that? Or
not prohibited, better late than never, yes. Yeah. No, you can worship Krishna anytime. If you're not able, then you have to apologize to Krishna. I'm sorry, you know, I should be doing this in the morning, but I can't do it. I'm sorry. Krishna is a person, you just apologize to him.
And second is that you talk about kirtan, right? So
yes.
Everybody doesn't do kirtan in the routine life. They can just chant. Maybe chanting some people can do.
Yes.
Sitting quietly and thinking something.
Oh, kirtan doesn't have to be loud.
Sorry?
You don't have to make it loud.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be loud kirtan. But it shouldn't be silent. At least you should be able to hear it. Maybe the person next to you doesn't want to hear it. But it should be audible. It shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be completely silent. It should be whispered at least. Then it's kirtan. Because if we do it silently, then our minds don't concentrate. When we hear it, then it fixes our mind. You know, the ears have a potency. When you actually hear something and not just think it, then the mind is easily fixed. If you just do it mentally, then you can you know, not pay attention to it.
What is the difference in chanting and kirtan? Suppose you chant this mantra within our mind.
Well, technically kirtan means some kirtan. See, we talk about kirtana, that's a general term. That's any kind of chanting is kirtan. Even the japa, quiet japa, whispering, can also be called kirtan. But we have another term, some kirtan. You know, complete kirtan. And that's when several devotees get together and they have a loud kirtan. That's some kirtan, actually. But that's especially pleasing to Lord Chaitanya, but we can't be doing that all the time. Yeah, not possible. But there should be some chanting. If we just try to do silent meditation, we probably won't be very successful at it. We probably won't be able to concentrate. When we do it audibly, it makes it a lot easier. Just like, you know, people who know something about teaching techniques, they know that if a student, you know, does his exercises out loud, practices a sentence or something out loud, he can memorize it, he can concentrate on it better than if he just does it silently. So our meditation should be out loud, at least so we can hear it ourselves, even if it's not loud enough to disturb others. Okay. Hare Krishna. Yes, ma'am.
This question is not related to this topic.
Yes.
But in case of Atma, in 18th chapter, it's written that there are five things for any work to be done. Five things are required to do any type of work.
Yes.
Soul, body, and all. So it's written that soul is the doer. Whatever we do, the soul does it. And if I'm not...
Adhisthanam tathakarta karanam cha pritak vidam vividas cha pritak cha daivam cha ivatra cha panchamam. Five factors. The Adhisthanam is the location or the situation, and the doer, which is the soul. The soul is the karta. But he's not the only active agent. All five agents are active. The body, the demigods, the activity itself, Dhyapam, was it?
Senses.
These are all factors in the activity. The soul is only one of them. He's not, when it says he's not the doer, that means he's not the only doer. But he's the conscious one. The other factors are not alive. He's the one who's alive. They're the person. The rest of them are just forces, energies. So you call him the doer, but he's not independent. He's under the influence of these other factors, and if these other factors are not favorable, he can't do a thing.
My question is, in second chapter when we read about soul, it's written that soul does not involve itself in any activity, whatever the body does. So how does it get involved?
That's not to be taken literal. It, you know, understood together with that description of the five factors of activities, he's not by himself a doer. But the soul is active. Who's wiggling this finger? Me. You know, it's my body. I decided I want to wiggle. This is a conscious activity. It's not just a, an unconscious reflex or some tick or something. I'm deciding I want to wiggle my finger. It's me, the soul, doing it. So what do you mean the soul doesn't act? I'm acting. But I'm only acting because the demigod in charge of the finger is cooperating with me. That demigod gets mad at me, and then I won't be able to move the finger anymore. Or any other factor goes bad. You know, lights go out, I won't be able to see. So the five factors have to cooperate with me. I'm only one of the agents. But I am active, I'm just not independently active. Is that okay? You know, we shouldn't take it literally that the soul is completely inactive. That's not our philosophy. Yeah. We're not free to act just any way we want. We got other factors we have to deal with. But we are. I mean, we have desires and we carry out those desires by acting. That's life. Yes?
If I'm not mistaken, the explanation
yes.
of Jali, you understand that we can just desire and regret the real activity carried out by Paramatma, who is the ultimate actor.
Okay, he's the ultimate actor. Okay, Paramatma is the real actor. But the other verse says the Prakriti is the Prakriti Kriyamani, material nature is the actor. I think it's something like Einstein's theory of relativity, that it, you know, it depends on which point of view you're looking from. It's a super soul, it's nature, it's you, it's, you know, it depends how you look at it. Okay. Yes. Okay, forgot.
How can one actually love Krishna? What are the qualifications of Krishna?
That you're ready to give yourself completely to Krishna, and you're not compromising with him. You're giving him everything. That you have, your desire is simply Krishna's satisfaction. No selfish mixed motive. No selfishness. Only Krishna's happiness is all you care for. That's what it means to love anybody, is only to care for that person's happiness. So, love of God means the same thing as love of anybody else. Only wanting that person's happiness. No conditions, nothing selfish. But we generally have selfish side motives that get in the way of our devotion. That's why our devotion is not pure. Get rid of those and your devotion will be pure.
Sometimes we don't understand what Krishna wants. How to decide that?
With
3 years to go, you don't understand what Krishna wants.
Yes. It's because we have those distractions. Our minds are not clear. And therefore we don't know what Krishna wants, we don't know what anybody wants, and we don't know anything. Because we're confused. If we surrender to Krishna, that will clear up also. And because we can gradually find out what Krishna wants, we study the scriptures, we consult with spiritual authorities, you know, but from Guru Shastra and Sadhu, we can find out more, you know, to some extent, more or less what Krishna wants. And sometimes Krishna doesn't want to let you know what he wants. And so, you know, he can be tricky too. He can conceal his desires. Sometimes devotees are put into quandaries by Krishna just to intensify their devotion. You know, they don't even know what Krishna wants of them. And therefore they're going crazy out of anxiety. But that's actually the anxiety of their detachment to him increasing more and more. Like, Krishna, I don't know what you want from me, but still I'm your sold-out servant. Even if you keep me in confusion. And that stimulates the devotees, sometimes that's what Krishna's doing, stimulating the devotee's transcendental anxiety by keeping him in doubt. You know, I'm only going to surrender to Krishna if he tells me exactly what he wants from me. But that's not unconditional love. I will surrender to Krishna even if he keeps me in doubt. And doesn't even let me know what he wants from me. That's full surrender.
What about good we do, it's Krishna who is making us do. And what about bad we do, it's the karma which we did earlier. Sometimes we take the credit and we enjoy the credit of good things. And we want to put our name and enjoy the fame.
That's crooked.
Yeah.
That's deceit.
How
that's
come out of this greed?
Well, we can realize what it is. We're cheating Krishna. And maybe we'll be ashamed of it and stop doing it. You know, blame Krishna for everything bad and take the credit for everything, for ourselves, take the credit for everything that's good. That's really cheating. So, just having that philosophical understanding of it should make someone ashamed. You know, just stop acting like that. Okay? Yeah. Please, yeah.
In Sadhana Bhakti, say that morning Mangalarti is there and chanting Krishna. Is it wrong to do chanting first and arti and all afterwards?
There may be some circumstance where that's okay to chant.
If somebody prefers to do chanting first, is it wrong?
It depends on the circumstance of his life. If he's a brahmachari living in the temple, he shouldn't be making up his own rules. When do you want to have Mangalarti? 2 o'clock in the afternoon?
No,
it depends.
No, in the morning only, around 6 or 6:30. Is it preferable to do, if somebody prefers to do chanting first, is it wrong?
Not necessarily. The chanting is more important. Chanting is more important. If one of them has to suffer, then let the arti suffer. If it's a choice between chanting and having a proper arti, then let the arti suffer. If you can't have both, if you're just too short for time, then do the chanting. Is that okay? I mean, is that controversial?
Normally, arti should be first and then chanting.
But what if you don't have time for both?
If you have time, then what should be first?
Okay, do the arti first, if you have time. But suppose you don't have time. Suppose you only have a half hour, and you promise to chant 8 rounds. So do the chanting. That's my recommendation. That's the more important thing. If you have time for both, yeah. The arti, proper thing is arti should be, even in the temples, get up at 2:30, chant all your rounds before 4:30, before the Mangalarti. That's the best thing. Get up so early you can chant all your rounds before Mangalarti. Well, then you do what you can, but you want the ideal, that's the ideal. Get up at 2 o'clock. Yeah.
Can we really do Mangalarti at 6 o'clock? Like,
Grihastha might have to compromise like that. Why?
These artis are in tune with the schedule of Krishna, so...
Yeah, so it's not properly the Mangalarti, it's a midday or mid-morning arti, then. If it's, you know, if it's past 5:15, it's probably not really Mangalarti anymore. Krishna's already had his Mangalarti. Yeah, but not everybody can do that in their house. So okay, have arti when you can. Maybe you can't technically call it Mangalarti.
Prabhupada also, I read not clear about it.
Yes.
Prabhupada instructed that in northern, near the Arctic, where the days are longer in winter, he instructed that Mangalarti should take place a bit late. That means just before sunrise.
Yes, because the Mangalarti should be synchronized with the Brahma Muhurta. It should be during the Brahma Muhurta period. And if you keep it fixed at the same time throughout the year, you may miss the Brahma Muhurta period altogether. And I think that's done in some temples in India, outside of ISKCON, they have a change of schedule for the winter and summer. It's fairly common. Because beginning of day is sunrise. Not the, you know, the clock time, but the solar time. Day begins with the sunrise. And everything should be relative to that. Brahma Muhurta is, I guess it stops a few minutes, 15 minutes before the dawn or something. Yeah, but it's relative to the sunrise. And the sunrise moves up and the Brahma Muhurta moves. And so the Mangalarti should also move with it, actually. But it's too complicated to change it every day, you know, 1 minute every day. That would be just, you know, drive anybody crazy. But at least twice a year you can change the time. Okay? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Om Gloriya Srila Prabhupada Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.